Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and our Learning College. Today we're going to continue with Siege by James Mason. This is a collection organized, I guess, topically or thematically of material taken from his newsletter, which was published from 1980 to 1986, I believe. And we'll do 2.16 through 2.1 or 2.30. So the middle third of chapter 2, which is about armed revolution. And I think it was, let's see what it was even called. That was, where is it? Revolution Through Armed Struggle. And you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also alexlinder.com. Follow me on Gab if you like, the free speech alternative to Twitter. And I have my own blog now. I've been doing daily for a couple of months. That's going to kind of run by seasons, and I'll take a little time off and then restart it for season two, but it'll run at least through mid-August, and I might take a little break at that point. But that is at alinderblog.blogspot.com. I call it integumentary material. Now let's return to Siege 2.16. The NSLF, National Socialist Liberation Front, one-man army. Once you have geared yourself up to think in purely revolutionary terms, things don't seem so one way anymore. If you view yourself as among the last of a dying breed and then proceed to act accordingly, then that's exactly what you've become. If you view the fact that you're broke on account of having little or no faith in capitalism, and yet believe that it is worth infinitely more to be a noble revolutionary being than to exist as a, quote, consumer, then that is your sterling badge of honor. If you seek to defend a capitalist system and still find yourself broken struggling, that is the mark of a fool. If you seek to take refuge from an encroaching system, then you are like a fox on the run. If you are determined instead to place the system under siege, then you have become truly revolutionary. Money is filthy stuff. The means by which sneaks, cowards, weaklings, capitalists, bureaucrats, and Jews conduct every affair. It is the very means by which they are measured and judged, and as the money continues to grow more and more rotten with each passing day, so too is their individual worth eroded. Take away their money and you have nothing. They are not men, and neither are we, the moment we imagine we can or even should fight them and their system on their own ground, by their rules. The dawn of day will break through the moment their foul money the dawn of day will break through the moment their foul money system either collapses under its own rotten weight or is blown to pieces by us. And as I read you, the U.S. is $20 trillion in debt. When they can't pay off their minions any longer, when they can't appease the hordes of savages in the cities, that's when we, who have endured their worst while being penniless, will become the immediate new masters, because in the meantime we have grown incredibly tough and resourceful. And why must the right wing always fall into the trap of basing each and every decision and move on the wish that things were somehow other than they actually are? Why can't they base their actions on things as they exist? Why in the world struggle to get ourselves all bottled up when the enemy is already bottled up for us? The Jews, the blacks, the bureaucracy, every source of filth and decadence emanates from the major cities of the U.S. How would a total breakdown, a general strike, a civil war, a total revolution affect these man-made hellholes? They would, in short order, die with the death they so richly deserve. That very thing is well within the capabilities of a small band of fanatics, each member a one-man army. Let's have none of their effeminate money games, and let's have none of this garbage of withdrawing from the field where we are presently and confining ourselves within restricted, defensive boundaries. Let us instead fully enjoin the concept of the one-man army, capital O-M-A, the one-man army, and bring the struggle to the enemy. Wherever you may be at this moment, let the revolution be there also. Spread a little revolution wherever you go. Never gripe about the system. Project the revolution. Get the people around you thinking in terms of totality and not in terms of inches and degrees. Point out the real enemy and not just the noisy, obnoxious systems. Tell everyone it is the system itself that must go. Convey the feeling that it will be good to have all true white men and women as comrades in arms in the revolution. Don't try to promulgate a faith. There's already too much of that. Be a spark for revolution. Don't be a harbinger of doom. Be a carrier of revolution. Volume 10, Number 1, January 1981. 2.17, strike hard, strike deep. I am compelled at this time to add my voice to those few who have demanded that such things as Phase 1 type activities must stop. Simply such nonsense as trying to make headlines, confront the enemy, or rally the white masses won't work, never has worked, and almost always results in merely revealing our weaknesses and making us look like idiots. The very strategy itself calls for numbers which we do not have at this time. My view is that just because the Jews and liberals have succeeded in making goyim out of the vast majority of whites, we need not sacrifice ourselves in the vain attempt at proving them wrong. We have got to trash can 1933 strategy and tactics. They won't work. Moving on to page 60. For a decent street demonstration, you must have anywhere from 50 to 100 uniformed and disciplined troopers. We have managed 50 on several occasions, and 100 only on one occasion. For the rest, it is pitiful and ineffectual, futile, counterproductive, and I might add, costly and dangerous. As much as I hate to see a good comrade wounded in such useless actions, I hate worse to see the sacrifice of millions of lives in World War II that went into building the terrific reputation that we have enjoyed and are now wasting as these, quote, Laurel and Hardy stunts gradually destroy our image. We don't have to set ourselves up for big letdowns. The enemy does that for us. I will admit right here that it does require guts to stage these demonstrations. The tragedy that we can no longer tolerate is that those guts are wasted in this manner. Doing it the way it's been done in the past gives the enemy full advantage of his power and places us at the mercy of our own weakness. It's got to stop now. First, never announce your plans in any manner whatsoever. Second, forget about the use of uniforms unless and until you have a standing army of your own, numbering 50 as a flat minimum. From experience, I know that with 50 National Socialists, one can do anything, anywhere, anytime. With 50. Better still, as Tomasi said, forget such activities as might be used in a campaign to gain political power. Rather, go instead to activities designed and intended to hurt the enemy. All caps, hurt the enemy. And for these activities, in my own opinion, two participants are one too many. Also, in my humble opinion, it is a ridiculous risk and waste to mess with the material body of the enemy, as he has all our tax money to mend himself, just as a lizard will grow a new limb. The physical body of the enemy, however, is so utterly flabby that he positively can't stand very much of an intensified assault of this kind. In short, it would seem to me that any intelligence at all would lead comrades to know how to stop hitting the enemy, to know to stop hitting the enemy where he laughs, and start hitting him where he screams. Strike hard and strike deep to build the climate for revolution where even the most craven of white cowards will be compelled to join in or else die. But for God's sake, stop wasting yourselves and your efforts and making the rest of us look like damned idiots. Volume 10, Number 2, February 1981. 2.18. What movement? Whose movement? The Nazi movement? The Klan movement? States' rights? Racial nationalist? German-American? Anti-communist? Majority rights? White Christian? White conservative? For practically every cell of the hard right in this country, you'll find a separate definition of what the movement is, as well as what the goal is, and the methods for achieving that goal. Not to mention the identity of that special person to lead us onto that great destiny. Some of it gets pretty damn ridiculous, which is why I stopped where I was in listing movement brand names above. It is never my intent to offend anyone doing the best they can. There are huge ideological and theoretical differences in these movement groupings, but because these are in the realm of thought and paperwork, they are rendered as very slight when compared to the main tasks we each purport to undertake, and when compared to those fundamentals we definitely share in common. The problem comes in when movement people start thinking and acting as though there exists already some kind of pie to carve up, some bag of marbles to be taken home. Perhaps more than a few place much higher emphasis on giving the effect of doing something instead of doing something in fact. A serious man will usually be found willing to work, but a fun seeker generally will refuse to be parted from his plaything. I found part of the solution to this age-old problem we face in the pages of an issue of Pastor Miles's From the Mountain. One good comrade, Rocky Sujeda, used the term resistance movement in reference to the pro-white, anti-Jewish struggle we are all involved in. This is a natural. It answers so many of the criteria left out by all the other names for the overall movement that I've heard of to date. Most importantly, it isn't funky and doesn't reek of the useless, crappy right-wingism which has practically made dirty words of nationalist, American, and even white when used in group names and movement efforts. With resistance movement, we eliminate any inference of divided loyalties and mixed priorities such as with for God and race and nation. Most important of all, the name implies a kind of dead seriousness and strikes down the stupid, silly notion that somehow we are all big wheels, each vying for a piece of the political pie. It reduces the concept of the movement to its most basic common denominator, survival. In two words, resistance movement, it poses to the intelligent mind most of the ultimate questions of the day. Resistance to what? What are the real forces in the land to be resisted? And what power is behind these forces? Which segment of the population is actually resisting? Which are coexisting, and which are actually in support of these controlling forces? At the quickest glance, any observer will see that we speak of the general anti-white drive afoot in every branch, at every level of officialdom. And they will know what it is we are resistant to, ZOG, the Zionist Occupation Government. They will know that we do not alternate between established political parties because the system, the establishment, controls them all. He will see that we are resistant to the takeover of our government and our land by an enemy of our people. The term may not be the most original, but it does provoke the right thought, and it does fit the situation perfectly. Furthermore, it is a term that each of us, without exception, should be freely able to identify with and wholeheartedly subscribe to. The better-known resistance, the one in France during the German occupation, contained elements from the entire political spectrum, from Gaullists to communists and back again. But they were united into one purpose, and they were very effective, as any history of the French resistance will reveal. None of our own elements in the present day are nearly so far apart as were many of those in France during the 1940s. Our similarities are greater. There is far more at stake, and the enemy today is the ultimate world enemy. According to all this, then, we should vastly outdo any efforts of the French underground of the Second World War, who were merely out to liberate their soil from the military presence of a white Northern European neighbor, Germany. We are out to remove all traces of an alien presence wherever the white race is found. I hope that this may provide some of the basis that must be hammered out toward the formation of a true, functioning movement, and that we may freely repair to its common usage as we struggle to build this movement while we yet have the spare time on our hands to do so. And that was from Volume 11, Number 4, April 1982. 219, 2.19, the three R's. No matter how one cuts it, there are but three steps which must be followed toward revolution, successful revolution. These are resist, revolt, and rule. In the first, one finds oneself disillusioned, alienated. Then, becoming more aware and intelligent of his circumstances, he enters the movement and perhaps becomes further alienated, but, if he has the stuff within him, he becomes hardened and agile. He gains instinct, and he begins the course of educate, agitate, and organize. In the second step, he has learned that he must strike quickly, hard, and decisively. He takes care to see that there can be no turning back compromise. Compromise has long since been discarded. He has in the forefront of his thoughts the awareness that only the most determined and the most radical can hope to master the situation ultimately. In the final step, he harbors no regrets. He puts an end to his opposition. He sees that the drastic measures called for will, for a time, result in a more simplistic society, but one vastly more just and healthy than before. He joyfully accepts the task he establishes to create the new order. White men will never rule their own lives and destinies again without a successful revolt, and no revolt can materialize without the intensive period of resistance, the basic preparatory stage of the revolutionary movement's development. Attempting to revolt now would be suicidal, while attempting to rule at present through compromise by trying to win a local election is rather a whimsical dream. We must first successfully resist, which entails pulling ourselves together, getting up on our feet, and ceasing to roll with the blows. It means having enough organization to be able to call a number of shots, felt directly on a national, if not worldwide, scale, on our own. It means mounting a series of national socialist or white victories. It amounts to a coming of age and becoming truly the movement to do the job. The trick or key to this is nothing so new. Off and on in the recent past, we've seen it almost done by one or another movement grouping or leader. But what has been missing and what must now be fulfilled is a movement functioning and acting in unison, maintaining, increasing, bringing into focus, and bearing its full strength as it is called for. A team, a network, a syndicate, an effective political entity. To become functional and effective is the phase we must achieve. There are no others. Never have I been a user of Commander Rockwell's four phases because I am sure that the concept became obsolete soon after his death. I would rather give it a decent burial as a good idea that might have worked in its time instead of going on like others, abusing it as a double talk item, double talk term, as an excuse for introversion and wheel spinning. The fakers are stuck in phase two, right where Commander Rockwell died, and there they shall always remain. The NSLF will not subscribe to outdated strategy. Rather, we must come to realize that the only correct strategy is that which is dictated to us by reality. It may sound easy, but the proviso is, have we got the will, determination, and the courage to selflessly follow these sometimes harsh dictates? Volume 11, number 5, May 1982, that was. 2.20, 220. The masses, or the mass as a whole, can only be looked upon as a coward. They say a brave man dies but one death, whereas the coward dies 1,000 times inside. Within these millions upon millions of pieces of biomass, there exists the kind of alienation, resentment, fear, frustration, and burning hate, all largely undefined, that is so terrible and potentially explosive that its full power can only be guessed at. So far, the trigger or fuse hasn't been found. Bleeding and pounding by the system isn't going to do it. They just roll over like a spaniel when kicked and crawl back for more. So far, the Jews have succeeded in pulling out all stops at getting and keeping the masses docile and distracted, pampered and entertained to the point where no reason and nothing reasonable can get through to them. That's where the answer must lie hidden. Something unreasonable. Something that doesn't even make sense. Something they can neither anticipate nor cope with afterward. Tomasi was among many revolutionists who knew that if a revolution were ever sparked in this country, it would be done by one lone incident that had all the dimensions necessary to catch fire and spread in all directions at once. It is the missing factor. It is why the times we are living in are the roughest, because nothing that is truly nothing dramatic and widespread is happening that is truly revolutionary. This also means that the greatest heroes and heroines of all are those who have in recent times sacrificed in an attempt, and those in the near future who will sacrifice and succeed in the task of blowing the bottom out of the situation. thus allowing new moves to be made free from interference by the paid forces of an intact Big Brother pig system. That moment, when it comes, will be the pivot point in affairs, when Big Brother's hand is reduced and ours increases until it is the only one. The tempering we have undergone will pay huge dividends when Big Brother's money power is broken and the criteria for mastery becomes the greatest degree of awareness, discipline, and ruthlessness in the hands of those with the greatest drive and will to power. In this we are not alone. We just better see to it that it spells us when the time comes. And that was from Volume 10, Number 4, April 1981. 221. Priorities now, perfection later. One of Commander Rockwell's best, most loyal fighters and administrators, Robert Lloyd, once gave me one of the essences of the nature of the present struggle we are involved in when he stated that none of us, not even the best among us, are anything close to the ideal which we are all fighting for. This was a simple, non-emotional, uncomplicated clarification of the plain reality of the situation, all wishful thinking aside. To go further, even in Germany during the time of the NSDAP, the ideal that was sought after was perhaps centuries away, and to be sure, the human stock in America today comes closer to what the Germans of the 30s and 40s referred to as Untermensch. Take a look at the armies of mouth-breathing knuckle-draggers on these streets and realize that they are what passes white. It will, of course, require centuries of the most careful upbreeding to reverse the dangerous and alarming mess we have before us today. That can only be accomplished by the most stringent measures on the part of the highest governmental authority, and that, in itself, implies directly a total revolution victorious in our favor. In the meantime, we'll do well to guard our own bloodlines and to multiply and perpetuate ourselves and our belief in the best kind of quality as conditions and circumstances allow. But it has always seemed to me ironical that this avowedly racist movement has placed the attitude and behavior of its adherents above the genetic quality of the same. As the old rationale of the 70s ran, so what if he's a Jew? He's the best leader we have right now. Meaning that he spouted the right line and went out and got the sensational headlines. But if a man was white and adopted a totally unfamiliar and unfunky revolutionary line and strategy, and regardless whether he made hot headlines of his own, then these others would curse him into the ground. So it goes today with the majority of those our comrades who have been jailed by the system for having actually gone on the attack rather than just sit back. To me, the reasoning, or lack of it, behind this attitude is unfathomable. What do these do-nothings expect? Do they expect some silent majority type, all squeaky clean in his lifestyle, background, and personal appearance, to step out of the endless, nondescript line he stands in and pull the trigger? In these earliest, most desperate stages, do they expect the targets, the actual victims, to be a revolutionary theoretician's dream? What the hell do they want? It would appear that they want perfection going in. Or else, if not that, they use this claim to hide what they really want. Nothing to rock the boat and possibly enrage Big Brother into coming down with both feet and ruining everybody's fun, quote unquote. Lenin said that you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. And one black saying of the 60s was that you have to use what you've got in order to get what you need or want. We'll never get to that point where we can begin breeding supermen if we can't get our values and priorities squared away today. Trotsky said that, as revolutionaries, our only compulsion is circumstances, not wishful thinking. It means that we have to do what we have to do and by any means necessary. Lenin, Trotsky, and the swarming army of blacks in the 60s are the farthest cry from what we believe in, but they have been infinitely more successful than we have in getting what they are after. That is very simply because they accepted the truth that the end does, after all, justify the means. I would say it's because they had media support, rather than that's the difference, not what they did, because mostly what they did was pretty stupid. Let us drop the dreaming, the faking, and the immature unreality and recruit an army of the worst, if need be, in order to smash the beast system and make way for the ideal to dominate the planet and the universe 10,000 years from now. For our part, we will welcome and honor as comrades any white, bar none, who wishes to join with us in the struggle. Any action taken against the enemy, no holds barred, is a heroic deed. For our part, we will tolerate no divisive moralism to hamstring our efforts. Volume 13, Number 10, October 1984. 2.22. State of emergency. Are you among the conventional survivalists with a few guns, a few rounds of ammunition, some medical supplies, maybe a CB radio, and enough food and water for anywhere from 2 days to 2 years stored away? Are you one of the ruggedly individualistic types who, as long as he owns his firearm, swears by God that this is a free land and he is a free man? Or are you one of those intrepid ones who says he'll, quote, shoot the first nigger that comes rampaging up onto his front porch? In other words, do you count yourself among those rednecks who are smug in their sense of right-wing style readiness? If so, you can stop reading right here. Years ago, I wrote, after headlines appeared about the discovery of Wesley Swift's hideout and arsenal that included everything from automatic weapons to armored vehicles, that if Swift, who died in the late 60s, could have foreseen the day when, after his death, all his expensive preparations were unearthed and captured by the system without a fight, that surely he would have viewed it as the end of all hope of resistance. He had expected a full-blown invasion of the U.S. by Russian and Chinese troops, and I know of no group or individual who was as well prepared for the worst of emergencies as was Dr. Wesley Swift. The, quote, emergency, unquote, never came. Swift died a natural death, and the government scooped up his vast arsenal. Even Commander Rockwell was positive that the blacks were going to go on an all-out rampage before the decade of the 60s was out and touch off the race war that so many talked about in those days. In 1967, the year of his death, he had begun to organize what he called the White Guard on a quicker, more informal basis than the stormtroopers, so sure was he that hell would break loose that very year. 67. But a massive welfare payoff, a general caving in of white resistance, and perhaps even a shift in enemy strategy, kept the conflict from coming out into the open. It was just about 2 years ago that a number of otherwise respectable and credible right-wing groups were issuing super serious, straight-faced accounts of how, in the summer of 1983, Ronald Reagan would die in office, the economy would fall right through the bottom, and coloreds everywhere would go berserk. This was the prediction from experts who were thereby, unfortunately, placing their reputations on the line. I recall at about the same time one particularly provocative and sensational sheet released, not by what I would want to call kooks, but by major government movement standard bearers, to the effect that in the upcoming weeks the Antichrist himself would seize all television networks and automatically turn on all TV sets that might be off at the time and mesmerize any and all whose glance was caught. Thank God the movement has a shorter than hell memory span, otherwise that one would be impossible to live down. Through no fault of his own, Commander Rockwell's "The Jews are through in 72" never materialized, and 1972 came and went uneventfully. Black riots slowed and practically ceased. The economy certainly worsened, but did not collapse. The government, the society, and the country itself is becoming more and more like one big, giant, pulsating blob of a stinking, noxious Jew. The next major landmark in time, 1984, is behind us. And I'm betting strong that one of the favorites of the fakers, 1988, will come and go likewise and hardly even be noticed. I wasn't long in figuring out that it really meant sticking your neck way out to venture to put a date on practically anything of a social or historic nature. It's gambling of the worst sort unless you yourself have the means at hand to force the issue according to your own timetable. It is simply that there has never before existed a more controlled environment than the one in which we exist today. Things don't just, quote, happen anymore. If they don't come off Big Brother's drawing board, then they're not sanctioned, and most of the time don't take place at all, or if they do, they're of a nature hardly worthy of note. Big Brother is in control. This plus the fact that the population doesn't give a damn. Things are slipping constantly, gradually, but no significant upsets are being allowed that might either alarm the populace or provide the revolutionists an opening to take advantage of. I don't expect it to change unless someone changes it. In fact, as well as in theory, we are in the period of beyond 1984. From here on, we can forget about even George Orwell. Of course, the astute have been aware all along that 1984 had come into effect long before it ever arrived in the calendar. And I, for one, about a decade ago, abandoned the, quote, emergency school of thought. That is, betting in favor of and preparing for something of a very sudden and fixed nature to occur to transform the situation. Something which has to be braced for, weathered in a comparatively short, if harsh, period, and then to be emerged from on the dawn of a new day. I do favor full preparation for a lights-out type emergency, but that would probably be of a rather long duration, and, again, short-term thinking is useless. The whole thought was false all along, but up until perhaps this decade, the majority could have claimed ignorance. I began to sense the true nature of the situation, as I said, about 10 years ago, mainly because of experience born of intense involvement in revolutionary activity and thought. But for the rest, the object lessons are all there now. Many can't grasp it. No one really wants to realize such a fact, but there are also plenty who refuse to be parted from their fun and games like children they expect and want it all now. Want it all now. What we face is not an emergency, nothing of a romantic or extraordinary nature, but rather an indefinite period of what Warren G. Harding would term normalcy. I know that taken individually or collectively, the manifestations of contemporary society are anything but normal to us, but as far as the great numbers and great periods of time are concerned, they are quite normal indeed. Therefore, we are the abnormal and the out of place. We have always been such, except that, until now, most have figured that Der Tag was just around the corner, which would turn things topsy-turvy in our favor. That is not about to happen. What it means for each of us is this. As long as there was a hope, real or imagined, of a sudden change in the most basic course of things, then we could almost afford to hide behind our unreal attitude and approach to the situation with a, you'll see, thought guiding us. Presently it has to be clear to all that nothing of the sort is going to be allowed to happen, and events are going to maintain a strictly business-as-usual complexion for the foreseeable future. And it is impossible to hide behind an abnormal strategy for very long in a stolidly normal environment where nothing out of the ordinary is permitted to happen. And when I emphasize like that, it generally means all caps. It should be added right away that those who do continue to go on in the manner of the past do so as utter and complete fools. Are you going to go on kidding yourself? Telling yourself that you'll be ready for it when it comes? If you're a reactionary and a right-wing type, then it may well require a sudden emergency to get you off your ass. But if you are a revolutionary, then for you, it is here right now, and always has been here, right around you. You were born into it, and unless you kill it, it is going to kill you. Having nothing initially to do with the name of this publication, what we have to adapt to is not a sudden emergency and then back to normal, but instead a state of siege. The system will fall one day. But when? Certainly no time soon. I've said often in the past that the winner of this race, this Death Watch 2000, will be the one who finishes last. So it is up to each of us, individually, to see to it that we outlast the system. And you don't accomplish this by merely stockpiling anything, unless you're prepared to become a hermit for the next 50 years or so. You military buffs should already know that a static defense went out with the 19th century, and that now it is all up to the fast and the resourceful. What must our definition of victory now become? To have survived another day, another year. To exist in and amongst the system, but not as a consumer, not as a statistic or as a victim. To exist decently and, to be sure, to keep the wolves away from the door. If you're living smart, as you should be, you've already eliminated coloreds and criminals from your uppermost list and have gotten down to the very basics of defending against the real enemy, the capitalist foreclosers. The old right-wing types will know how to deal with a violent one-on-one situation, but how about the ever-encroaching system? Here is where you have to become smart. Commander Rockwell said that the purpose of life was to struggle as hard as you can for what you believe in and to enjoy the fight. You cannot fight to your fullest potential for what you believe in while being a full-time slave to help bolster the pig economy. And you certainly can't enjoy the fight existing under unrelenting social and economic pressure. The herds and armies of zombieized clones out there cannot or will not see that there is an alternative. The revolutionary will always find or make his own alternative. It is being done. And in this lies not only the definition of short-term victory, but the promise of ultimate victory one day. We will live. We will outlive the system. And should we individually not make it all the way, then we will not have been cheated, for we will have had our share. Living within the beast system as a revolutionary, day to day, is the real emergency, and it calls for emergency measures to be taken on a routine basis. To be able to exist thus is the victory. Volume 14, Number 1, January 1985. Linkage. Here's another new word to add to your vocabulary. Linkage. It used to be something known primarily to mechanics, but as of earlier this year, it could also be in your future. This one may replace entrapment as the latest dirty trick of the system designed to deflate any potential the movement may have before it can get off the ground. It's a quasi-legal takeoff on guilt by association, which even 10 years ago would never have held water, except that now the source from which the juries and grand juries are drawn is sufficiently conditioned that they'll indict or convict on cue from the system. This arose out of the serious scare given to the system by one splinter of the movement calling itself the Order. The system, so surprised and enraged that there is any fight left anywhere, sought to tie in or link as many other movement facets as they thought they could in order to, if not wipe them out totally, at least pin them down in a defensive legal jungle wherein they either retain expensive counsel or lose by default. Some top movement people were literally on the run, and others were sweating blood a few months ago because of it. So to be reminded, the bastards won't quit. You must, if you ever run seriously afoul of the system to where they can lay a legalistic finger on you, either disappear totally or confront them totally. No use playing. Around here, we didn't worry so much about it, the sedition trial investigations, though we had about as much to do with the Order as did those who were being officially harassed, that is, practically nothing at all. Our sympathies and our support for the Order ran the same as the others as well. That is, 100%, as witnessed by those issues of siege released at that time. Help for members of the Order? We were also in a position to lend about as much tangible support for those men as were the rest. Zero. Again, the main difference was, we felt, correctly as it turned out, we were in fact untouchable in the newest system craze of linkage. No, he has been linked to this, is one of their common formulations. Until things take a very radical turn, I'll stand firm on one thing I've always said regarding system persecution. I've never yet seen smoke where there has not been some actual fire. The system cannot yet invent its cases out of thin air. They can orchestrate them, but that requires your willing participation. They must have something to go on, however shaky, and they can only get that through their own agents or through you. In the case involving the Order, their prime move was based upon one of the annual gatherings held by the Aryan Nations Group of Idaho, from out of which came the majority, if not all, of the members of the Order. Those who attended that latest gathering before the Order took their course of action were wide open and subject to the latest linkage ploy to shut us down. Simply, if you were there, you must be involved. Long before any of this was ever dreamt of, I ceased attending movement gatherings. In complete candor, I did so because I dislike reruns, especially when they entail traveling long distances and shelling out cash so drastically scarce. Frankly, I can't afford the journey, plus I doubt there's anything I could add that they haven't already heard, and vice versa. The only thing that might have come out of such an expensive trip would have been my own name and a federal subpoena, and that I can really well live without. No, those few men calling themselves the Order said more in a month of furious action than the rest of us have said in 20 years. And of what significance to them at that point in time were federal subpoenas and the like? I don't mind paying the price, but by God, I demand the price be worth paying. Even before I stopped traveling around to movement functions, I had become as disinterested in such measly and bothersome things as memberships, etc. This really caused much anxiety among the Faker figureheads I've acted as a general secretary for in the past. As Commander Rockwell said in the 60s, there is but one membership, known loosely as the Movement, which is bled white and thoroughly confused and dissipated by dozens and dozens of useless, crappy fronts. In order to squeeze a tiny portion of the general pool of money held by the common membership, one is required to invest comparatively huge sums in becoming a professional mail-order con artist, and, in the case of Nazi types, to engage in silly-looking and potentially disastrous stunts for the press, which are then fed back to the membership to jack off their emotions and draw a little more money. That's right-wingism, but it's not revolution, and I got tired of it. That was from Volume 14, Number 7, July 1985. Or that was Number 7, not from it, but it. 224, probability. At this stage of things, kidding ourselves would probably prove fatal sooner or later. I urge against taking it on the chin or leading with the chin, as there are violent revolutionary types out there aplenty to get things kicked off good and proper. Blacks, every shade of color in between, not to mention fanatic reds, etc., plus nuts and more nuts. Add to this the slowly but steadily deteriorating conditions in the country, economic and otherwise, and you have a cake baking in the oven. You don't want your cake to fall, and you certainly don't want to get yourself burnt. Instead, you want to be around for the icing, and most definitely the eating of the cake, meaning the final seizure of power and exercising of same. Most communist outfits share so much in common with the Democratic Party platform that they'd be stupid to start any general disorder, and they know it. Only the extreme left can be looked to for hope in this area, black and colored nationalists as well. The cities, where these types reign supreme anyway, will always be the first to erupt when it's time for things to jump off. As far as the first wave up against the system's pigs is concerned, I'd much rather it be them instead of us. They're primed and psyched up for it already, armed to the very teeth, and suffer no shortage of expendable manpower. And any blame would be leveled towards them in the event of a miscarriage. Wish them well. Recall the cornerstone of the U.S. Nazi movement's grand strategy of the 60s? Rings crazy as hell today, in light of developments over the past 10 or 15 years. It involved depending upon and even helping the pigs against the urban revolutionaries. We'd be absolute idiots to attack the pigs ourselves in any attempt to initiate something of the nature of a general rebellion. I cannot urge strongly enough, stay out of their way. Deprive them completely of any excuse to come after you. This does not mean stay legal. It means stay sane and rational. And stay alive and at full liberty, because dead or locked up, you're no good to yourself or the revolution. Let the revolutionary mobs, over whom we have no control and who would also kill us, take the brunt of the first, strongest system counterattacks, and let these same numberless mobs in the cities chew the hell out of the system's hired elite. It couldn't happen to a sweeter bunch. There will probably be more than one revolution, back to back. The Reds and the Blacks, because this is what they preached and prepared for all along, can be expected to lead the way. In the opening days and weeks of this phase, we can watch how the system is going to react and how well it reacts. For us to attempt the same thing in the middle of an atmosphere of order would be outright suicide. Once there exists an air of disorder, the cards will be more in our favor, and we'll be dealing in the smaller cities and towns, the countryside, where it might be possible to take things without the massive death and destruction that will occur in the major cities. Ultimatums, backed up by very real force, handed to local governments once they've learned just what happens to their big city brethren, might just work wonders. Only after the system is broken and discredited will there come a hope of mobilizing the masses of whites to tackle the job of winning what will soon enough assume the characteristics of a civil war. Until then, for the present, give the pigs nothing to do regarding ourselves but sit and get edgy. Once the shooting starts, keep out of the way of the mobs, because they only perceive us as friends and allies of the capitalists and the system. In the opening phases of the revolution, if the red mobs don't get you, the pigs will. Let them instead kill one another. Developments will progress rapidly once all central power is gone and people realize they have nothing to lose anymore. And that was volume 14, number 9, September 1985. Now, 225, Terrorism Redefined. Do we still happily accede to wearing just any favorite smear term the Jew system and its media chooses to hang on us, like the way Commander Rockwell did with adopting their term Nazi? Or do we draw a line at how far we'll allow these misnomers to go? Of course, to them, it doesn't matter, and neither does it matter to the sheepish masses of Goyim what they call us or how we are thought of, but it does matter to us the way we view ourselves and the nature of our struggle. We should not consider ourselves terrorists any more than we should consider ourselves racist, even though we accept both as facts of life. Nor should we take it lightly when members of the right, who should know better, refer to us as such. We need to keep our definitions straight. Who is a terrorist? When considering the hundreds of thousands of elderly whites who are frightened to death inside and outside their homes on an unending basis because the system coddles and protects the criminal element, officially, is that not terrorism? Brainwash and taste-making aside, when any individual knows clearly in his own mind that to buck the Jewish liberal-inspired consensus on everything from race to sex habits will lead to public ostracism and loss of employment, if not outright legal prosecution, is that not terrorism? Kids brutalized and intimidated on a daily basis, year in and year out, because of savages they are forced into school buildings with, because of government policy, is that not terrorism? Millions of white workers struggling against losing odds with taxes and inflation, facing loss of homes and all forms of security, oftentimes wondering where food is going to come from, or where the winter heat will come from, because of official Jewish capitalist economy and the mafia-style Internal Revenue Service, is this not terrorism? Yes, it most definitely is terrorism, and on a monumental scale. Worse than that, it is terrorism without the guts to present itself as such. But just as Adolf Hitler pointed out regarding the Jewish use of the big lie technique, if you do it big enough, no one will recognize it for what it actually is. A case of the kettle calling the pot black. Because it is the system which owns and controls the media, none of the above outlined horrors are described as what they in reality are. But let one individual or a small group of individuals dare to strike back, that, to the controlled media and softened brains of the masses, is terrorism. That gets the dirty name because it is small-scale and direct. It is a game, and the game is force. We can expect no better from them, but we must get it straight in our own minds if this struggle is to succeed. Most of this country's founding fathers believed that the rights of the white men who built the country would be guaranteed by the petition and redress clauses written into the Constitution. But other men, like Thomas Jefferson, didn't think so. Neither did Benjamin Franklin, who accurately predicted just what shape this country would be in by the time of its bicentennial, with the Jews in the counting houses and the whites toiling away like slaves, and with a sold-out government flying directly in the faces of the interest and the will of the majority. It is tyranny which rules this land today, and nothing more or less. It is an alien tyranny and a Big Brother 1984-style tyranny, because we don't even enjoy the dubious pleasure of knowing or being able to see our tyrant. But one thing is known, he is not white. It is a tyranny hiding under a cloak of democracy, a clever disguise which prevents any blame from being placed on, and which allows the monster to perpetuate itself through chicanery, referred to as the two-party system. It is true that the removal of one or a dozen goyish frontmen will not alter or remedy the situation. Only a total revolution can change it. But there must be a beginning, that first step in the thousand-mile journey, and the first steps are always the hardest. When speaking of terrorism, a line must be drawn between two types of terrorism, selective and indiscriminate. Some members of the movement howl and complain over system persecution. True, this is an example of selective terrorism because I assure you, facing the system's prisons can be a terrifying prospect, But as Hitler said, unless one picks up the daily Jewish press and sees himself slandered and vilified therein, he simply had wasted the previous day. Comrades, you must expect that the system will attack, but when it does, for God's sake, let it be for something. No more damnable, pitiable frame-ups. Bring the attack to the enemy. With regard to indiscriminate terrorism, the only difference between the prevailing conditions I outlined earlier in this segment and, for example, a black massacre of a white settlement is the degree of subtlety used and the time lapse. A Katanga savage with a machete or an IRS agent in a gray flannel suit, take your pick, your money or your life. These methods are designed for three purposes: to cow a population, to fleece a population, or to annihilate a population. Not infrequently do all three happen, one after the other. Terrorism is a two-way street, for, as Hitler stated, the only answer to terrorism is stronger terrorism. We do face a naked tyranny here in the U.S., and it is employing terrorism to, first, wipe out the whites as a majority, force, and, ultimately, to wipe them out as a race altogether. The system knows, and we know, that we are left no choice whatsoever. It is fight or die. We are then out to liberate a nation from alien tyranny. It won't be easy. When lightning is striking, blows are falling, history is turning, and the stupid ones are groaning, "Oh, isn't this violence awful?" we say, "To hell with such lily livers. They haven't seen anything yet." Volume 10, Number 11, November 1981. 226, Defining the Radical Extreme. The question of who and which is the farthest out. For what reasons and toward what purpose? Among these types would be included all of the pioneers, the groundbreakers, the innovators, the outrageous, the unpopular, the unprofitable, the dangerous, the controversial, the misunderstood, and those in advance of their times. It's been said that the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, that the only aberration is abstention. What all of this does on the practical side amounts to the elimination of the surprise element, minimizes the chance of disillusionment, builds confidence and self-reliance, and helps gain for the one mastery of almost any situation. It also rids us of the cowards and fakers as well as opportunists, as long as they can't use it or hide behind it. We can tolerate being regarded as inhabiting the far reaches of the outer limits if it means never being caught dragging behind anyone else. It behooves us to smile at those who today disparage our message if by our so doing we are striking out on the course that they themselves must one day follow. We would be fools and cowards to shirk the task and take for granted that someone else might take it up in our stead. We have so little to lose at this point and so much to gain, our prime enemies being stagnation, dogma, and muddle. It requires some daring and imagination to become the vanguard of a movement, and to remain so takes constant reappraisal and reevaluation. Had not Commander Rockwell taken the bull by the horns and risked everything, his good name as a conservative, over 20 years ago, where today would the racialist movement in the United States be? What was in 1960 the most dynamic and futuristic thinking, today is shared by practically one and all. But it was only through the supreme sacrifice of one man who was able to see farther than the rest in his own time. And still the situation demands more, far more. We could easily have another 20 years of marching ahead of us, but it cannot be directionless marching, and it cannot be marching in circles. People like to stay with what's comfortable, especially those with a broad conservative streak in them. People dislike the shit disturbers. However, comfort and routine do not make a revolution. Where once Gus Hall was a firebrand with the power to shock the pants off all of us, today he is an old fogey. Seems as though all our real National Socialist leaders die in battle before they get the chance to atrophy thus. Maybe we are blessed in that manner. What we want and what we believe we have achieved is to make the NSLF synonymous with the radical extreme. And when you seek to define the radical extreme, you need only recite those four letters to have it completely summed up. That was Volume 11, Number 7, July 1982. 227, one hell of an article. In the October-November issue of the National Sheriff magazine, there appears an article entitled Posse Comitatus, Threat of the County-Based Criminal Militarists. The article is remarkable not only because the entire front cover of that issue is devoted to it, or because it is of exceptional length, or because it reads like something from out of the good old days of the radical right, but because it focuses attention on what has to be considered a genuine ray of light on an otherwise dark and dreary scene. It was written by one Philip C. McGuire, who is the Assistant Director of Criminal Enforcement for the BATF, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And so we may accept this as top of the run from the system point of view. Given within the article is the genesis of the Posse Comitatus, including the names, dates, and places relevant to its birth and development. The article gives the people and places and events that started the Posse Comitatus. The blazing incident involving Gordon Call is given the space and attention it is due. An explanation of what Posse Comitatus means and stands for, which couldn't fail to appeal to the right kind of person, is included. The movement accusation against the Jews is given. Familiar movement groups and publications are listed in connection. An outstanding and highly technical listing of armament recommended by the Posse Comitatus is recreated at length. To properly appreciate the flavor of the article, it is useful to quote the final two paragraphs in their entirety. Quote, based on the above information, it is apparent that certain members of the PC pose a clear and dangerous threat to society. Their reported philosophy of racism, anti-Semitism, and their total disrespect for non-elected law enforcement officers must be a major concern to all law enforcement agencies. Care must be taken when confronting these members to ensure that we do not look upon them as, quote, just another tax protester. They have proven that they will injure and kill law enforcement officers in the furtherance of their cause. Recall that between February 13, 1983, and June 3, 1983, Gordon W. Call and other members of the North Dakota PC killed three law enforcement officers and wounded an additional three officers. If you have any questions concerning the potential firearms and explosives violations in your area, or if you need assistance in conducting firearms and explosives investigations against members of these types of groups, please contact your nearest ATF office for assistance. Volume 12, number 11, November 1983. 228. IRS. There's a special hatred and, yes, fear in my heart for the IRS. Their blood-sucking touched off a near calamity here 2 years ago. Starting at that time, and increasingly ever since, my wits in that area have pulled about even with the sharpness of theirs, and so a red-hot confrontation with them is not in the offing. Stave the system off where possible, rip it off where possible, attack it where possible. But this has not been the case with others. Gordon Call, most notably, K-A-H-L. And, according to the news on television the other night, it was not the case with about 800 people last year alone. These were reported as violent attacks or assaults against agents of the IRS. As a result, the agents are now packing guns, that is, if they weren't before, and as though they need an excuse now. Self-defense, it was referred to as on television. Robbers is a fitting term for them, but not even vampire approaches the depth of vileness and contemptibility they maintain. 800 people defended themselves last year against what are now armed robbers, and the system was surprised and maddened when they didn't simply fork over their earnings without a mutter of protest. What maddens me is why, to date, not more deaths on the side of the system. The number 800 approximates the number of movement hardcore members of about 15 years ago, and it takes a pretty hardcore customer to buck up against those vampires in three-piece suits. Who are these people? Where did these incidents take place? Are they all in federal prison now? They are unknown, unnamed, and most certainly unorganized. 800 is a number that can be seen as large in some respects, but small in others. But these 800 skipped the preliminaries and came directly into contact with the enemy itself. That is purely revolutionary, whether even they realized it or not. Anyway, it got on the news. Let their numbers increase 100-fold, and the revolution will be won. Volume 14, Number 7, July 1985. 229. The hell of it is that we ourselves aren't at all immune from the horrific things that are in store for the future. If we were somehow isolated or insulated from it, then none of what is today bringing it on would bother or concern us. If that was the case, I doubt whether we'd be in the struggle at all. But this is not a laboratory experiment that we can shelve, lock up, and walk away from. This is a fight for survival, and we are not immune from the hell that we must strive to see gets broken loose. Any halfway normal person might be expected to come up with a rejoinder like this. Why do we do it? We do it because one thing is clear. The current deadlock must be broken at all cost. It is frighteningly obvious that nothing positive can be expected to happen with the way things are now. Therefore, a different atmosphere must be created, in which some kind of positive change can be effected. Again, the normal person might say that there is enough already with disorder, enough hell and chaos going on right now, without adding more. What they don't see is that we have in this country an ordered disorder, which was made to order by and for Big Brother. Don't you believe that they could stop crime, subversion, and anarchy if they really wanted to? All the hell and disorder of the past, and the general crime wave today, is the greatest help to Big Brother, his system, and his establishment. The Black Riots gave the insurance companies carte blanche to remove the gloves and start extorting small businessmen and all the rest of us. The limited anarchy and the limited insurrection of the blacks and the reds just gives Big Brother more alibi to tighten the lid of the electronic surveillance society, to stampede legislation to disarm the populace. All the runaway non-white crime merely gives cover and justification for the erection of a police state, the reins of power firmly in the hands of the Jews. They don't want it stamped out. They need it for the completion of their plans. What they fear most is total disorder, which they can't control. That which they can't monitor or control doesn't serve their interests. It's been said that we don't want to rock the boat, we want to sink it. When we succeed in blowing the bottom right out, we're going to have to hurry topside, over the rail, and swim for life, leaving the rats to drown with the ship. That's Volume 10, Number 4, April 1981. And last segment for, or last subsection for this segment will be 230, Longest Sought After. A winning, successful course of action not dependent upon a central organization or a major leader figure. Between Alpha and Omega, not existing at extreme ends of the spectrum, will be found the answer. What does amount to suicide is going straight from doing nothing to taking on the entire system in direct, violent confrontation. There does not exist, and we cannot stand around and hope for, either the organization or the leader to, quote, tell us what to do. That outfit or that man would be pounced upon and destroyed in an instant by the system. We have to think for ourselves at first, and then we go on to direct our own actions. The first step has got to be giving up all stupid and false notions. Those who are basic cowards or who are otherwise hopelessly inadequate to the task cannot and will not participate, cannot and will not part with these notions ever, that they need some leadership. They can't think for themselves. False ideas are any which stray from the ground zero reality that all evil springs from the system. The system will never correct itself. It will never permit anyone or anything to correct it. It will never tolerate or allow the development of any true alternate system to compete legally against it. Nothing of a positive or partial nature can be accomplished while the system stands. Those who embark upon a course which runs contrary to that which the system has determined must understand that they embark on a life and death struggle. It is the one duty and one goal of the revolutionary to struggle for the death of the system. So much is bound up in realizing the totality of the situation that little else can be added to that except to say that once it has been comprehended, the person then at once begins to see everything, every situation, in a different light. Things are clearer. The course of action becomes obvious. In the old revolutionary axiom, educate, agitate, and organize, the term education is basic. Not the type of education as thought of by reactionaries, but the kind of information which provides years of revolutionary experience in a week or a month. without the necessity of having to live it over painful, dangerous, useless decades such as we have had to endure. To impart knowledge and expertise to our next wave, our next generation, in precisely the same manner and for precisely the same reasons as our former institutes of higher learning used to teach their students, to build upon a solid foundation, to increase the chances of, and to hasten ever greater achievements, it is a science, not a diversion or a money-making racket. The movement has got to stop peddling garbage and start instructing in revolution. Next, to agitate. The problem becomes more complex as it leads out of the confines of home or hideaway and from the safety of the typewriter and the postal service. You are not out to sell a product, a gimmick, or a certain approach. You are not out to refight the Civil or the Second World War. You are not out to blow minds. Neither are you out to idly grumble or complain. You are out to clarify, to polarize, and to intensify that which faces all of us every day. And it is to be directed, in every case, against the system itself, the ultimate culprit, never toward simply blacks or Jews or liberals or anything else which skirts or evades the issue and which sounds like and is reactionary, and for which not even a fool nowadays will respond favorably or positively. A revolutionary comrade is one who leads. You lead by taking people over barriers of time and understanding toward ultimate confrontation with reality. And that reality is the best, most irritative source of agitation possible. Such is the rightness of our cause. You do not agitate by placing yourself in the center of brawls. Lesser still, by aiding the system and making people despise you. You do it anonymously by making people know and hate the system. Finally, to organize. That in which the movement has consistently failed the worst. An organization does not exist for its own sake. Nothing ever starts out that way. The system, as have all such systems in the past, is ending up that way. To promote the club, the leader, the name, the symbol, or the approach soon becomes everything. Infighting takes over. Petty competitions take care of the rest. Nothing is served. So it has always gone. To truly organize effectively means having some place to hide on the other side of the country, anytime, for any reason. It means secrets being kept. It means material help when it is needed. It means a unified line and a unified response in the face of crises. It means respect and cooperation. It means loyalty. It means to multiply ourselves in a coordinated way to give the effect of a giant, a unit. Organization as opposed to organizations does not give the effect of a lot of duplicates ignoring each other and getting into each other's way. It means to affect hands and feet, arms and legs, eyes and ears, everywhere, simultaneously. Acting in one common cause and one common interest, in iron discipline, ultimately to lead to one organism with a common intelligence, instinct, voice, and above all, a common will. How little does any of the above description resemble what has passed heretofore as these very things? Education, agitation, and organization. And that was Volume 14, Number 11, November 1985. So that will conclude this segment, which was taken from the middle third of Chapter 2 about armed revolution. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll conclude Chapter 2 of Siege.